I remember saying to my wife several times, I said, you know, over the years, I said, this is not going to last forever. I just want to enjoy every day of it, every show. And so when they told us they weren't renewing our contract, it was a big blow. It was a big devastating blow. But in many ways, I was kind of ready for it. And so I was like, yep, well, that day was coming. And
do they give specific reason or about, you know, elaborate? I mean,
hopefully we have a very solid podcast today.
So too, yes.
I want to learn everything. To be honest, I want to hear about the journey, working at the Score to the Starters to this current tour you're on. I guess starting off with your love for basketball, where did that stem from?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so I grew up in I was a third of three boys, and mum and dad were both very, you know, active and sporty. And so basketball in the town I grew up in was something that almost every kid played, boys and girls, because in summer we have cricket in Australia, and then in winter we have Australian rules football, where I'm from in Melbourne. But basketball is all year round, you know. So, like, it was really not just about the game, it was kind of a social activity as well. You know, we got to know a lot of families and friends who would go to the stadium, because you would go two or three times a week for junior games, for me and my brothers, dad's games, and then mum would play netball. And so sometimes you would even be up there for that, depending on just...
What's netball? What's netball?
So netball is a game that is a very much a Commonwealth game. It's played in England, Australia, Canada, South Africa, place like that. You have basically hoops at each end of the court, but there's no backboard, and it's mainly a sport played by women and females. There's a lot more men playing it now, but it's a really cool game because you can't dribble the ball, so you have to sort of pass the ball. It's all about ball movement and passing it, but not everyone can shoot either. Only two people on each team can shoot, so it's a really fun game.
Yeah.
So, basketball was kind of in my life before I even knew it, really. And so I always enjoyed playing it. And then the big moment in my life really came in 1987 when my oldest brother got hold of the 1987 All-Star game. Because at that point, I had only really seen highlights of Dr. J and Larry Bird and things like that. And in Australia in the 80s, there was no internet, of course. There was no cable TV. So when my brother finally got hold of a real game, it was the All-Star game, which, if you're not aware of, this was, in my opinion, still the greatest All-Star game ever played, because it had all the legends: Michael, Magic, Charles, Larry, Dr. J, Akeem Olajuwon. Everybody was playing, and it came down to the last play of the game where the West were down by 2 points. Rolando Blackman got the ball, drove inside. Four players on the East jumped on him. He got fouled. He went to the free throw line, knocked them both in, tied the game, went to overtime, and the West went on to win the game. Now, I was about 11 years old at the time, and I was big into WWF. So, I don't know if I knew the WWF was faked at the time, but every wrestling contest had this incredible climactic ending. And they all had these names, you know, Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan and King Kong Bundy, you know, great names. And so in the basketball world, you know, as I say, Dr. J, Larry Bird, Air Jordan. So it was kind of like that they could have been the same thing. Like, and I just instantly fell in love with basketball. And from that point on, I really then tried to do everything I could to get hold of any access to NBA.
Apologies. Here we had an Amazon delivery interruption. I tried my best to steer the conversation back on course. We were talking about getting a hold of this All-Star game, yeah, and then you changing your life course to focus on all things related to basketball.
Yeah, and so I did everything I could to get hold of, like, Hoop Magazine and Basketball Digest and things like that, and that really gave me, like, magazines and information on more than just one or two teams. Like, it was on the whole league. And in one of those magazines, they had the addresses of the team addresses of every team in the league, including the NBA office. And so I got out the old pen and paper, and I just started writing to literally every team I could think of, or every team there. and just saying, hey, I'm your big fan from Australia. I love, you know, XX player, whatever it is on your team, you know. And most teams wrote back to me and sent something in the mail, whether it was a postcard or a, you know, photo of the team or something. And I just, I mean, it was such a cool experience, because it's something that won't ever happen anymore in life, because no one writes letters. And certainly people, you know, like if you want to contact someone, you email them, you find a website, you go into their comment section or whatever. And so, you know, I would post these things, and from Australia to America, again, it would take, you know, 3 months sometimes even longer before you would get a response. But anytime they sent me anything, that was like real Christmas and real Santa Claus, you know. And so I kept all those little bits and pieces over the years, even the envelopes. Like I've got an envelope from the New York Knicks when they sent me a card and things like that. So yeah, I really wanted to know more and more about the league. But of course, it was hard to get to the United States to work as well. As I sort of progressed through my teens and into my 20s, I always had this desire to go to America, but you can't just sort of apply for a visa like you can for Canada or England, where you can get a reciprocal working holiday visa. So I went to England, I lived there for like 6 years, and then a friend of mine was in Toronto, and I was like, well, I can get to Toronto, and they've got the Raptors. Close enough, you know, good enough. Yeah. And so I went to Canada and I lived in Toronto. And at the time I was like, I'm not, you know, looking for a relationship or anything like that. I just had a 1 year working holiday visa for Canada. And I'm just going to go to as many Raptors games as I can, and I'm going to enjoy it and do all that. And then what happened was I met a girl about, you know, 6 weeks or so after I arrived in Canada. And one thing led to another, and we've just celebrated our 16th wedding anniversary a couple of months ago.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Congratulations.
So, thank you. So once we got married, then what happened was, you know, again, I had no career. I had no, you know, real direction. I had no qualification or skills, but a sports journalism school opened in Toronto. And I was like, man, I've got to, you know, this is the thing I need to get into. And so I went and spoke to the people there, and I had to audition. You sort of had to audition to just see, they wanted to see if you were worth it. And I succeeded in that. And then they hit me with the sledgehammer, which was like, this is going to cost $17,000 a year. And I'm just like,
ah, yes. Yep.
You know,
good old Canada, yeah. American education.
Yeah. And I'm just like, okay, I've got no money for this. And anyway, my wife, I told her about it, and she was like, well, listen, this is what you want to do though. So we have to figure out a way to get the money. And her sister of all people, you know, we'd only been married a year, and her sister was like, well, I can lend in the money. I've got the money. And I'm like, oh my God, I've just married this girl, and now I'm taking money from her family. You know, how am I going to pay it back? But they didn't hesitate.
The classic, come over into my country, find the first female and give me a classic move.
You know, so once they, you know, they said, listen, we're prepared to do this. You know, I was like, well, I'm going to go for it. And so I went and I applied. So I you know, went through the process, and I got accepted into the school, and it was a 2 year course. And halfway through the first year, I got an internship at the Score in Toronto. And I just did anything I could at the Score to sort of keep turning up. And, you know, when you're an intern, depending on the circumstances, mine was kind of like they were happy to take any sort of free work I was offering, and I was happy to do it, you know, before we didn't have any kids. And so I just turned up literally as often as I could and volunteered to do everything. It was baseball, golf, tennis, wrestling, football, American football, you know, basketball, motor racing, you know, anything that they needed. I just grabbed the camera and I was out trying to become like a web producer. And about a year or so after I started, the Basketball Jones joined, which was Skeets and Tass and JD. Now, I knew about their podcast, but I didn't know they were Canadian. I just assumed they were American, you know, but then they were working at the Score, and I'm like, man, these guys are doing a basketball podcast every day. I got to get in on this. And so I just kind of made myself known to them as often as I could. The same sort of thing, you know, you just like, oh, hi guys, I'm actually just walking past your office again. I like basketball, you know, like, yeah, I'm into it. And ironically enough, my break came during the NBA lockout in 2011, because these guys were doing a daily NBA podcast, but there was no NBA to podcast about. And somehow, I still don't understand how, but they convinced the bosses at the Score to send them around the United States for the what was called the No Season Required Tour, where it was like, you know what, there's no basketball, we're just going to podcast anyway and go to these different cities and turn up and do it. And they invited me to join them. And so when they did that, I was like, yes, all right, I'm in for sure. And so I joined them on this tour, and the season was announced that it was coming back. I think it was on Thanksgiving in 2011, and they were going to start on Christmas Day. And so at the end of this trip, it was a five-week trip around America, I just said, you know, I really want to keep working with you guys. They were the same. And so we started working together from that moment on.
That's crazy.
Yeah. You know, so many things had to happen for it to all happen. Like the funny thing is, if the strike had never happened, maybe I wouldn't have been working with them, you know. And the other thing was, I'd actually just gotten back from a trip to Australia because my wife was pregnant with our first child, and we went to Australia. And I just got back, and the day after I got back, I was walking past their office again, you know, just like, hey, in case you guys have forgotten. And that's when they sort of stopped me and said, hey, you want to come on this trip? And I'm so glad that I didn't stay an extra week in Australia, because maybe they offered it,
right,
and offered it to somebody else. And I said yes to them before I even asked my wife, because I felt it was better to just say, yep, take that. And then if it doesn't work out, you can sort of give it back. But don't give someone else a chance to, you know,
come in and swoop in. And yeah, true.
Now, my wife was pregnant, but she wasn't like due to give birth. She was only 3 months in. So it wasn't like I was going to miss the birth of our child or anything like that. I mean, I wouldn't have gone, but my wife, I told her about it, you know, I asked her, even though I'd accepted already, and she was like, go for it, you know, so I did. And then, yeah, 2 years later, 2 years later, we joined NBA TV here in Atlanta, although those conversations began, you know, probably 18 months or so before we joined, we moved down to Atlanta, because NBA TV were looking for content. They liked our podcast. But
can I ask a question actually before
please.
I forget?
Yeah.
During that time when it was the lockout season and this show was still going on, was there other stuff going on as well, or was it very limited in terms of NBA related content because of this? And was that like a kind of a pivotal point for the show?
No, there was no NBA at all. Like there was nothing. The NBA, in fact, NBA.com, I think, almost went into sort of a file not found mode because,
really?
So there was nothing. And what happened was, you know, again, like these guys who were just signed on, you know, so they were getting paid, were like, we don't have a league to talk about. And not only that, they then pitched that it was going to cost, I don't know exactly how much, but a couple hundred thousand, I'm sure, to send people around them. Like,
yeah, of course.
You know,
the production.
But the Score, to their credit, and the owner was a fantastic guy, John Levy. You don't sign off on something like that unless you are someone who's a bit of a forward thinker. And he did an incredible job by believing in the guys and what they were doing. And you know, so I saw it as well, but I still was just like, I can't believe this is happening. But then, yeah, so then when we got back, then the talks with NBA TV ramped up pretty sort of soon after that. But the real question was just how we were going to get there, because getting visas to the United States, work visas, was not easy. But their lawyers and their immigration team, you know, put together a case and made it all happen. But it wasn't a pleasant process, because I assumed it was one of those things that once it gets approved, you're sort of like, okay, now you can come along and enter the country. But it wasn't. Even on the day we were arriving into America, you still, even though we had the visa approved and everything, you still have to convince the immigration officer at the airport.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, at the airport. Oh,
yeah.
At the airport. That I didn't know.
And in Canada, you go through U.S. Customs in Canada. So we arrived at the airport in Toronto, and even though we had, again, all the approval, all the documents, everything, the guy there was basically the last, you know, resort where he
can decide your fate. I had the same thing because I lived in Canada and I was working in the States as an engineer. And like, although everything legally checks out, like, yeah, you hire a qualified professional, you can work here, everything checks out, you have a contract. At the end of the day, that one guy that's going to give you the final stamp can still say, you know what, something doesn't feel right here. And he doesn't necessarily need the craziest excuse to just outright decline your thing, right? So that is kind of interesting that you would think it was such a massive organization, like you just don't have to do anything. You just don't have to worry about it, but it's still difficult. No.
And you actually sort of feel a little bit guilty and nervous as well because you're like, well, you know, because he said to me, you know, what makes you extraordinary and unique? That was the sort of category.
Right.
And you're kind of like, I mean, not much, to be honest. But
you have a great 3-point shot. Does he have a court nearby that you can?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and that's what happened actually one time. So when we came, in those first 5 years, every time we left America and came back in, we had to bring all our paperwork with us because we didn't have a green card. And there was one time I did come in from, I think it was only from Cancun or somewhere like that, and I had all the documents. And he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm on TV for NBA TV for basketball." And he's like, "You're Australian though." I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "But you're doing an NBA show." And I said, "Yeah." and he said, and he was like, "How did that happen?" You know, like it's something right. like that. And I pulled out
tell
my phone.
Tell me the whole story.
Yeah. And I got it up. I got the YouTube up on my phone. I said, "Look, that's me there." And he was like, "Oh, that's okay. Yeah, okay. That's cool.
Fair enough."
Like, yeah. But it was funny. It's funny to do that, you know, when you come into a country and say, "Look, I'm on TV, man. Look at me."
I mean, that's a cool flex. I mean, name a cooler flex than I'm on NBA TV.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Yeah. And it was great. And we did 6 seasons at NBA TV, 6 years. And it was just as awesome as people can imagine it to be. You know, we were there with friends discussing the NBA, going to the finals, going to the All-Star weekend. There were other trips where, you know, I proposed things and were accepted. And I mean, it was the most amazing experience. And the funny thing was, I remember saying to my wife several times, I said, you know, over the years, I said, "This is not going to last forever. I just want to enjoy every day of it, every show." And so when they told us they weren't renewing our contract, It was a big blow. It was a big devastating blow. But in many ways, I was kind of ready for it. And so I was like, "Yep, well, that day was coming." And
do they give specific reason or elaborate? I mean,
money, whichever. So very
viewership
vague.
Or
yeah,
something.
No, it wasn't that. It was money. Which money can cover so many areas. You know, like, are we not making enough money? Are we too expensive? You know, whatever. So once you just, well, basically that was all they said. They never really gave us like the you know, complete deep dive description, but it didn't matter because, like I say, when that happens, there's no appeal process or anything like that. You just you basically have to either, you know, you can either throw a tantrum and get upset and scream and yell at the world, or you can just go, "Well, this is life. You got to move on." And that's what
was
happened.
There other offers to stay on board in some facet to work with, or is it just like, figure it out?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, what happened was they told us in March and they said, "We're not renewing your contract, but we'll let you see out the season." So it wasn't like, you know, you're fired for bad performance, because that would be like effective immediately, get out the door. But instead it was like, "We'll let you see out the season." So in that way, I'm like, okay, well, I guess it's, you know, I guess when they do their numbers and they're budgeting for the next season, they don't see a way that this is, you know, creating enough revenue, whatever. Again, it doesn't matter. You can demand an answer and you can sit there and bang your fist on the table, or you can just go, "Hey, every single person I know in the media world has been laid off, fired, made redundant, you know, position."
I mean, same thing has happened to me in engineering. I was just going to say, like, literally had the same news one day. It's like, "Yeah, the department's going under. Like, we'd love to renew your contract, but we actually literally can't do it because we don't have." So I'm sure it's a thing that most people can relate to and understand.
For sure. And I honestly believe as well, those things in life are actually good for you, because it does give you that sort of reminder that nothing's permanent. And every now and again, you need to just like, okay, let's keep going. Let's try find something new to do. And if you didn't have those changes, and if you didn't have that sort of abrupt, change of direction, then you can get stale. So I was disappointed, but again, I got over it pretty quickly because I'm like, okay, well, what's next? I mean, I didn't, that whole journey to me to even get to that point was kind of unplanned and unexpected. And so I decided that, like, well, maybe something else will come from this.
You mean now you have such an insane resume and such a, I mean, to put that you worked for NBA TV is they don't need to give you a recommendation of any kind or like get you another job. You can find your own way in the basketball world, probably no problem. So an insane thing to just have on your repertoire.
Yeah, I mean, and that's it. Like, it's all stuff that people do know me from the show and from the podcast and things like that. And I try to leverage that as best I can, you know, certainly for what I'm doing now. You know, I try to let people know that, you know,
I've binge watched all your content. I've binge watched every Instagram. So I've seen most of the countries. I don't even remember all of them, but I think I've seen all of them.
Yeah. And you know, that's where I am at now, where I'm taking that same approach where I'm not exactly sure how it's all going to work out and exactly, you know, where it's going to go. But I really enjoy the unpredictability and the uncertainty of it because it's energizing. You know, I love being in that position where you don't quite know what's going to happen, you know, and, like when, you know, I'd been doing a podcast after the TV show for three years it was, but it felt honestly like four because of the COVID season. And we just did so many basketball podcasts that after a while you're like, I can't remember now what season this happened and who was the MVP and sure. things like that. And I could sort of see like, hang on, I'm going to be doing this for another 5 or 10 years, which is, again, it's not a bad outlook, but there was a part of me that was like, you know what, I was feeling there was something else I needed to sort of try to explore, and you know, now that I'm down this path of trying to do what I'm doing now, it's really invigorating and it's exhilarating as well, like just knowing that something might come from it, but even if it doesn't, putting yourself in that position where something could happen. That's what, you know, that's really to me what my sort of life philosophy is about is like, and you probably know this yourself as an expat now, you just turn up and you can't plan everything. You can't predict everything, but you turn up with the right attitude. It's amazing how things can just fall
absolutely.
Into place.
I think this is a expression that's really good for the situation. Like, don't let good be the enemy of great. I think you understand what you have and had was fantastic, but there is something else that you're clearly thriving and you're searching for it. So why stop yourself and be afraid of a challenge or a risk? That just seems silly.
And I mean, the thing is as well, I left home when I was 22 and growing up in Australia, you know, it's a great country to grow up in. I had a stable home, stable job, friends, family, everything around me. But even there was a part of me there that was like, you know, there's got to be more than just this.
Got to be more. Like, yes. Yeah. Of course.
And so yeah, I
very relatable to that. Very relatable. Yeah.
And I decided to go backpacking. I, you know, like a lot of, again, people at that age tend to sort of say, right, I want to go backpacking for a year. Now I was telling people like, I'm going for 2 years to Europe. I'm going to live in Europe. But inside I was like, if I last 6 weeks, that'll be, that'll be amazing because I'd never been away for that long, certainly on a non-holiday trip. And I flew over to England by myself. And I still remember to this day, you know, when you fly at night by yourself on an airplane, that's the loneliest place in the world. Your thoughts just, you know, are so intrusive. You're just like, what am I doing? I left my job, my friends. What am I, you know?
My family.
Yeah. And so I was fortunate that my grandma is from England. So I at least had a sort of home base to go to. But that only gives you a sort of temporary relief. It's like, because it's like you can't go and live with your grandma and, you know, just you've got to sort of go and make it on your own. And
it's like stepping stones that are falling. So you've got one, you have to jump to the next one immediately before it falls.
Absolutely. And so, you know, those first 6 weeks I remember in London, again, it was summer and it was, you know, I was having a great time. But when I went back to my, you know, my apartment at night, I was like, oh, man, am I homesick or what? And I can't put my finger on it exactly, but at some point there was like a switch where it was like, oh, okay, now I get it. Now I get why London's what it is. And I think a big part of it was the fact that I wasn't a big soccer fan. I mean, I followed soccer, but once I got to England, and I saw it was the season where Manchester United won the treble. So they won every competition.
Great time to be there.
Yeah. And so, but what it did was it just opened my eyes to, you know, it's like seeing a beautiful girl where you're just like, oh my God, like she's stunning, you know? And so So then I was
people
like,
don't get that football. They don't, some people don't get that reference because there is an atmosphere and a vibe that is really hard to explain when you step into a basketball arena or a football arena. That's it makes you emotional. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but just seeing the passion. It doesn't have to be my club. It can be, you know, another club that I don't even know. But I see how much a club means to people, and you can feel that in the air. And there's like you said, there's like a. It's like a beautiful girl. It makes you feel emotional.
Well, and that's the thing, especially if you've never experienced it at that level. You know, like I'd seen football, you know, the World Cup and things like that, and it was like, oh, that looks pretty cool. But then when you go there and you're at a game and you're like, oh, man, this is like now. Because, again, yeah, you're growing up in Australia, we played Aussie rules football where there's a lot more scoring. And so soccer was kind of like, oh, they don't score enough. 1-0, like who cares? But then you see a game and you watch it and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, I get it now. I get it now. So, yeah, you know, it was probably, again, 6 rough weeks, and then it went from that to me like, okay, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying in Europe. And here I am now 25 years later, and I keep saying to people, like, I'm still backpacking, sort of, technically, but not really.
Yeah, right. Where are you at now? Where are you today?
I'm in Atlanta, where I live.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in Mexico City last week.
Yep, and, saw that.
Yeah, oh, man, that's a wild place. That's one of my favorite cities for sure. But, yeah, so I've, you know, I think going back to sort of what we're saying about uncertainty and unplanned things, you know, I think when I first took that step to go backpacking as a 22-year-old, I was like, I knew I had to do it, and I was regretting it. Those, you know, I had homesickness. I was feeling really bad in those first month or so. But then the switch changed, and then I realized, like, okay, yeah, you can get out of Melbourne and see what else is there out there in the world, knowing that worst case scenario, you can go back home. And I just never did.
Yeah, fair. I was going to ask you, because I was a big fan of the Starters. You used to upload videos, I think it was late at night in Canada, Toronto time, I guess. I would always watch the 10, 11 p.m. show. I was like, oh, when they're going to upload? Because I didn't have NBA TV, so I was like, I'll just wait for the YouTube upload. How much preparation goes into a show like that? Because from the outside looking in, it seems like, you know, it's a couple of guys goofing around about basketball. But I imagine 28 minutes or whatever it was, 25, of television, of a production like that, is quite a task.
Yeah, well, it's only 22 minutes, in fact.
Which 22
is,
minutes.
I know, yeah, which is not very long. But what we would do is we would get in around sort of noon, 1 o'clock, to prepare for like a 7 o'clock show. And most of the topics kind of presented themselves the night before. You could get, for the most part, an understanding of what you're going to talk about. And so we would prepare like, okay, we're going to talk about this, we're going to talk about this, and then we're going to do this and this and this. But we wouldn't then say to each other like, okay, what's your position going to be? What angle are you going to take? We would then let that part of it become natural, because it's like the conversation you and I are having right now. Like you just sort of, it's like playing tennis. You sort of go off each other, go where the conversation takes you. So it was always a mix of like, okay, I'm going to prepare, like my own philosophy was, I'm going to prepare for both sides of the argument, because if Tass says one thing, then I don't want to just go, yeah, I agree, Tass, you're right. That's boring TV. But I also don't want to fabricate an argument or fabricate any sort of like, well, I'm just going to go against him no matter what he says, because I think that's also bad TV. You know, the ESPNs do that sort of stuff where it's just, you know, they like someone will tweet something, then they'll start debating.
It's getting old quick. It's getting older and older, quicker and quicker.
Yeah. And for some, you know, again, at my age, I think just with a bit of life experience, like I don't want to hear two people arguing when neither of them really believe what they're saying. You know, so I would try to prepare, you know, so that I could have counterpoints and you know, maybe push him here or there or whatever. And the other guys did the same. So we were kind of always ready to just at least create a conversation without it being a you know, this argument that is just this hot tempered
drama fest.
Exactly. Yeah. Screaming at each other. And then, you know, within the show, you know, at times the way I loved it, most of our shows, in fact, 99% of our shows were live, which was awesome, because there's such an energy when it's live, knowing that you screw up and you can't take it back.
Right.
And so it gets the adrenaline going. And the times that we did have to pre-record, for whatever reason, there was, you know, an issue here or there, it happened, they always took so much longer because when you were pre-recording, if you make a mistake, you could say, no, let's start again.
Let's do it again. Yeah.
And everyone's just like, oh.
The energy goes down. You can feel it in the video.
Yeah. You can, because you're like, if we make a mistake, we know we've got a safety net here. Whereas live, it's like, and there were times I said things on the air where I'm just like, oh my God, what am I, you know? So, but you also,
and the guys would jump, but that's what made the show fun. The guys would jump on it immediately and, you know, tease a little bit. That's what made the show fun.
Yeah. And, but you also realize like it was usually most of the time, you felt it was way worse than it actually was.
Right.
You were like, no one else really cared that much. But, you know, you would say things from time to time and you would come off the show and just like, oh, I'm going to get killed on Twitter. And then you'd come home and open Twitter and you know, maybe one or two. Yeah.
No like, one cares.
No one would really care that much. You know, so for the most part, it was never quite as bad as it felt in the moment. But again, I would never ever choose the pre-recorded over the live stuff because the pre-recorded stuff just felt it felt like you had to sort of get yourself up for it. Whereas the live stuff, you know, it was like running a marathon where you're just like, don't stop, man, just keep going. And you know, that was always really, really good fun.
The show had this interesting middle ground because none of you guys were professional players, so it wasn't like a TNT style, you know, three massive personalities being held together by Ernie, who's hilarious himself, obviously.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't like a, you know, an ESPN drama fest where guys would agree to have outrageous takes just for the sake of clickbait and outrageous takes. So that's why I kind of fulfilled this middle ground that didn't really, well, maybe it did exist, but I didn't see much of it in that time.
Yeah, well, and you know, that was the thing. We never pretended that we were, you know, former players. It was always like, hey, we're just fans like everyone else is. And so sometimes, often, people would email or message and say, man, me and my friends could do your job. You know, it's saying like, you guys aren't anything. And I would write back and say, you know, that's a compliment, you saying that, because, yeah, you could. We're just the same as you, man. We just, no one.
Go out and do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We didn't sit down one day and have this plan and this blueprint. It was just kind of like one thing led to another, to another, to another. And then that's the other thing I would always say to people. Say, guys, you've got a computer, you've got a microphone, you've got cameras. Go and do it. You know, and that's when it was like, I remember a couple of times, you know, people would say, oh yeah, me and my friends, we're going to buy a camera. We're going to go out and do it. And I said, okay, great. Let me know when you do it. And I'll be happy to watch watch your show do it. When they realize like, oh, what, you mean I have to actually work? You're not just going to fly me in, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I remember one guy said, you know, like, fly me into NBA TV and I'll show you how I'm better than you. And I'm like, yeah, you think that's how it works? That it's just like, you don't have to do anything. You just get given a free hit. And so when you sort of say to people like, listen, do your own show and get picked up by NBA TV and you'll be sitting right at this desk here with me. And they're, you know, that's when they're like, oh no, I don't want to have to go through and put in the hard work.
Of course.
I don't want to
talk. Talking smack is easy. Putting the work is hard. Everyone talks. Not everyone walks.
No. And, you know, I think it was always better to, you know, sort of, you know, not even shut down those guys, but instead, like, say, if you want to do it, this is what we did. You have the tools to do this.
Here's the blueprint. Yeah, you have the full blueprint. Yeah.
So go for it. It's all yours. And when you answer them like that, rather than just block them or tell them, you know, to nick off or whatever, that's when they're like, oh, I guess it's not just, you know, I think people thought, because again, we were four non-pros, that they just, NBA TV just recruited us off the street and just grabbed guys and said, you're doing a show, you know. It was funny like that. But again, I always try to take an approach where it's like, listen, I'll talk to anybody, I'll let you know what it is, but I want you also to understand that this wasn't like I just got lucky by being in the right place at the right time. I had to put in the effort and the work to get there.
Most times in life, when you do see people on a higher level in anything, you know, you only see that top of that mountain. You don't see the climb that it took to get there.
Yeah. And people, you know, think that there is some sort of secret sauce. But if you look at the people who really have made it in life, let's say Richard Branson, he's an example I often use. He's had so many failures along the way, you know, so many things that he's tried that just haven't worked. But he doesn't just get that one that goes, okay, well, this didn't work, so I give up on everything. It's like, okay, try something else. Keep going. And, you know, it's incredible how he doesn't really have – either some, you know, wild philosophy out there. He's just kind of like, I just try stuff. And some
do it again if
works.
I fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some things work and some things don't. But that's all my real plan is, you know. And another person who I admire greatly is Sarah Blakely, who I think she sold Spanx actually now, but she started Spanx just literally herself, walked around knocking on doors and saying, hey, you want to buy this, you know, this underwear and stuff like that. And so, you know, the belief that people are sort of just born into these great ideas and they're smooth sailing from day one and they know exactly what they're doing and how it's going to pan out, nobody does. But I think the most successful people have the same approach, which is like just keep on trying things and some will work and some won't.
Yeah, it'll just depend on the time. So after the starters, what do you do from there? Obviously, you're, you know, upset, devastated the show is ending, but you are okay with it. You've had quite a few years of success and you're moving on to the next chapter.
Yeah, so pretty quickly after, The Athletic was looking, they were moving from just like a website with articles into getting into podcasting. And so we had two agents at the time and they started talking with them, and The Athletic were pretty interested in having us come on as a podcast. And that conversation went fairly smoothly, to be honest. Like they were like, great, we need a podcast. Here's one that's available that's already kind of got an audience that's already established. And so, yeah, we started at the Athletic in 2019. So the following season. So there was real no downtime between shows. And we did that. I was there from 2019 to 2022. And in that time, of course, COVID hit. And so it was a crazy time. No one really knew what was going on there. And it was funny because when the NBA suspended the season, you know, so many other shows that rely on content were like, well, what do we do now? But we had done so many other shows that weren't just basketball related that it was actually not too difficult for us. We just pivoted to doing then we did Survivor and we did various other sort of shows on drafting, you know, things like top five restaurants in the world and things like that, building a band through, you know, all these things through musicians and that and stuff like that. So it was actually quite smooth. And I still remember at the time, I was like, this is funny. Like the NBA is not on, but I wasn't missing it either. I was like, this is actually good to talk about other stuff, to enjoy, you know, talking about other things. And then what happened was, you know, the NBA season came back and the bubble, and the NBA just jammed as many games in as they could. And then the next season started almost straight away. I think it technically was like 2 months, but it felt like the bubble ended. Then the next season happened, the draft. And I just remember we were doing the show from home. And even then I was thinking like, man, there's just, I'm just watching games every night and getting a little bit lost in them all because there was just so much going on. And so then once my wife and I got vaccinated and things started to open up a little bit, not all that much, but things, I remember saying to my wife, because we liked to travel and we hadn't traveled for like 18 months. And I said, if we can't travel now when we're vaccinated, then, you know, what's the point? Like, what's the point of being vaccinated? And so we decided to go to Europe and we took our sons with us. This was 2021. And we were like, let's just go, let's get out and live. And so we went. And while I was there, I was in Germany, I was in Berlin, and these guys were playing basketball, outdoor basketball, this at the flea market on a Sunday afternoon. And I was wearing like a button-up shirt and, you know, shorts. I wasn't expecting to play basketball. And these guys were there and I just said, hey, you know, I walked on the court and I sort of did the old, you know, do you mind if I play? And they said, sure. And so my son, who was, I think, 8 at the time or 9, he started rolling. He just started filming this game. And then afterwards, I put the clips up on my Instagram channel. And I got tons of people commenting and messaging me saying, oh, man, you know, if you're ever in my city, come out and play and I will organize a game and all this. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Because it's not like those clips of me out there, like, you know, crossing dudes over and hitting wild step backs and, you know, like it wasn't the basketball that was connecting with people. It was more, hey, you just
the community.
You're turning up at a court and playing basketball and having a great time. And so I didn't think too much of it. And then the following summer, we went back to Europe, and I was in Barcelona. And we actually went to Egypt first, and I had a friend, an Egyptian friend of mine, said, I'll organize you a run in Egypt, but it didn't happen. But on the way back, we were coming via Barcelona, but we were in Rome for like 3 nights. And so I put a message on my Instagram and I said, stories, and I said, I'm going to be in Rome on this date. If anyone can organize a game or let me know where to go for a game, hit me up. And it was one of the most engaged stories that I've ever posted. But no one from Rome said anything. People from all around the world, you know, from Tokyo and Brazil and South Africa were like, oh, come to my city. I'll get you a game. And I was like to my wife, this is crazy. Like, I can't get anyone from Rome, but I'm getting people from all around the world saying, you know, come and play basketball. Anyway, so I got a guy who said, if you're in Barcelona, I can help you out. And we were going to Barcelona for 2 days. And I said, sure. And so I turned up and he organized a run. And same thing, I put those highlights up on my Instagram channel and I got just flooded with messages from people just like, come here, come, you know, Argentina or Mexico, wherever. And that really did sort of start me thinking like, I wonder if I could turn this into something. I wonder if I could, you know, make this into some basketball traveling expedition. And the more I thought about it, I did another season of commenting, or, you know, of analyzing the NBA, but the more I thought about it, the more this idea really started to just fester within me where I'm like, I can't ignore this. Like, it was like, honestly, like something growing in your body where you're like, I can't just put this away and say no. Like, I've got a stable job. I'm, you know, analyzing the NBA. I've got that stability financially and career-wise in my life. But then my wife, you know, more we talked about it, she was like, go for it, man. Like, this is, you know, if you want to go for it, try it. Like, and to have that support from my wife, who again, 15 years earlier had stepped up when I was trying a new career path where, you know, there was a real financial responsibility, and she supported me then and she was supporting me this time. That's when I knew, I was like, I've got to, all right, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I have to bite the bullet and go out and do it. And so it was just over 12 months ago where I decided, that's it, I'm doing it. And I went out and I started doing it. And here I am now, 13 months.
The 2020 tour.
Yeah. Yeah. And the original goal, I just said the 20 and 20 and 20 tour because I'm like, if I can get to 20 countries, that'll be pretty good. It wasn't really anything more than just when people said, what are you doing? I'd say, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to go to 20 countries. So it was like a target. But the fact, you know, that I'm at 18 already, now I'm just going to sort of move that goal back. And I'm like, all right, I've done 20, or, you know, I will be at 20 here soon. I'm going to do another 20 because I've got still so many offers and so much interest from people that and it's so much fun. It's so fulfilling. It's so exciting that I'm like, all right, let's rack them up and go another
season
20
two.
More. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So,
that's awesome.
And hopefully, you know, I'll be able to entice someone like Netflix or Amazon, someone to come on board. That would be the, you know,
sure.
That would change. The goal. Yeah. Because then you get that real production behind it and you get real, you know, a real platform to boost it. Right now I'm just doing it all myself on social media. And yeah, I've gotten some pretty decent feedback and some pretty decent, you know, encouragement and motivation. But, you know, it's like anything. If you've got to sort of turn it somehow into then you've got to monetize it somehow. And that's the challenge.
That's the hardest part of anything on the internet.
Sure. But it's like anything as well. Like any startup, you know, you start in a hole. You know, no one starts ahead. So you have to sort of, you know, the proof of concept and the proof that you're actually going to do this rather than just talk about it, rather than it just be an idea, is really where it's at for me now, where I'm like, okay, I'm doing this one way or another. I'm hopefully going to do it well enough to the point where someone's like, hey, we want to get in on this and we'll help make it happen.
It's a great idea in many facets. I like the short form content in the sense that you get to work on so many different skill sets, how to, you know, grow an audience, how to market yourself. As you know, the biggest, you know, tool you can have is building an audience, and you can sell a show to anyone or you can get a job anywhere. If you have a little bit of an influence, that's not just, you know, temporary stability. That's stability for a long time to come. You know, if you have a good audience, good following, you'll always have something to do.
I mean, that really is it. You know, it all comes down to that. If you've got people who are interested in what you're doing, then they will become your audience. And then if you're able to sort of, you know, feed that beast, if you like, where more people see it, more people want to come involved, that makes it so much easier then to get someone on board, because they don't then have to, you know, they don't then have to go out and try to find an audience. You're saying, look, I've got one. I'm bringing it to you. And, you know, the actual, you know, definition of what an audience that you need to be able to convince someone, who knows the answer to that? You know, there's all those industry secrets. But ultimately for me, it's not about necessarily the size of the audience. It's just about the right type of audience, because I feel that I only need one person from Netflix to sort of catch wind of what I'm doing. And then they, you know, and then they take it to their boss and they sort of pitch it around there. And that's all you need. You don't need, you know, necessarily like, you know, a full out like attack where you're trying to get every single person's eyes at Netflix. You only need that one person who believes there could be something there that could really take things in its own direction. So, but also my focus, ultimately that is my goal, to get it on Netflix, but I'm not also letting that drive what I'm doing. What I'm trying to do is like just concentrate on doing the content, concentrate on keeping the momentum going. And if you're able to do that, the rest will take care of itself. I mean, I sound like a basketball player, you know, like you just
yeah, you gotta show up, gotta take shots at the gym, you know, 1,000 reps every day, and
that's it. You know,
you'll forget why you're a good shooter.
You'll forget, and honestly, it's like then, you know, if you plan, you know, and you prepare yourself as best you can and produce the best content you can.
Yeah. That applies to any form of content. I'm 100% in agreement with you there. Sure, you just keep getting better. Forget about the line at the end. Just run. Eventually, even if you don't see the line, just keep running. Eventually, it'll start getting closer and closer.
There's an absolutely incredible book written by Elizabeth Gilbert called Big Magic, and you know she wrote Eat, Pray, Love, which is a New York Times bestseller. She's had several bestsellers. But this book, Big Magic, I mean, if you're the sort of person who's like got an idea and you know, sometimes like all of us, you turn up and you're like, there's literally nothing in my brain today. You know, I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And then there are other days where it's like, oh my God, there's so much in my brain. How do I manage all this? You know?
Yeah. You thrive on that creativity well. And like sometimes it feels like the well is full and sometimes it feels like it's completely dry.
And it feels, not only is it dry, but it's almost got a lid over it and it was never there in the first place.
Yeah. Right.
You know, but she does such an incredible job in that book, really helping you understand that, for, you know, it's basically the same for all of us. There are days like, you know, you mentioned I've put together all my videos. I look back at some of my videos and I'm like, oh my God, I hate that video. I wish I did this different. I wish I changed this. But again, when I read her book, she's like, when I write a book, you know, it gets to the point where it's like, basically just publish it. I'm done with this book. I know I could change it. I know I could make edits. I know I could do things differently, but you also don't have to be perfect. You don't have to strive for perfection. You're never really going to reach it anyway. You're always going to want to just tweak things here and there. And I just found that really great to hear from someone who I thought of as this, again, incredibly
perfectionist,
successful.
Right?
Yeah. You know, New York Times bestseller. So like she doesn't have to prove anything to anyone, but she'll write a book. And she even says in that, she goes, I had no idea Eat, Pray, Love was going to be the hit that it was. And she goes, so nobody can really determine.
Predict these things. Yeah.
And so you just do them. You do them because you've done them and not because you're trying to do anything necessarily more from it. Just let whatever happens from it be the outcome and be happy with that. And so it's a great book. I highly recommend reading it, because it's also, for me, not a book that you read once and then you just put it on the shelf. It's like you almost,
it's a reminder, you can pull it up whenever you want, right?
Yeah. And you can find just even that paragraph. It's like, where it's like, okay, that's the one I was looking for. And it's like, okay, good.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I think there's a lot of stuff there that I can relate with. I actually switched careers from electrical engineering to full-time content creation. And it was just like at the start, like, oh, I just want to, you know, do this so quickly. I want to do it right now. I want to do it right away. Didn't take off till like 7-8 years into it. And that's when I even forgot that I could even, I forgot the hell I was doing, to be honest. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm still making videos. I guess I like doing it. And then one day it's like, someone's like, do you want to make money for us? Like make a video for us? We'll give you money. I'm like, you want to do that?
Yeah.
Why? They're like, I don't know. You made like 1,000 videos. I'm like, I guess. All right.
Yeah.
So just switch something else.
But that's it. I mean, you know, if someone had said to you 7 or 8 years ago, it's going to take you 7 or 8 years before you get to that point, you're probably going to look elsewhere, aren't you? I mean, you're like, oh,
yeah, man, 7 or 8 years. It's a long time.
But if you know, like it sounds like you obviously just kept at it, kept running that marathon.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe you
still running.
You stop for a drink every now and again. And you know what? The finish line is not the only metric to determine whether or not what you're doing is worth it. The finish line is merely a mark along the way. And that's how, you know, I try to remind myself. It's like, if I don't get this to Netflix, that doesn't mean it was a waste or not worth it or it was a failure, you know.
Yeah, you have so many experiences, the positive ones to take away from it, the traveling, the content maybe, you made.
Maybe it goes somewhere else, because when I started a year ago to where I am now, it's completely changed already what the sort of original idea was. And so that sort of evolution of the plan, or not even a plan, but evolution of the idea is like, oh, great. But there was no way of knowing that until you do it. And that's like so many things in life. It's same thing getting married. You know, you don't know what marriage is like. You don't understand all those marriage jokes until you get married. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, now I get it.
we'll forward this clip to the girlfriend. So
yeah.
I have a few questions about the 2020 tour. First of all, I'm curious, what kind of planning goes into it? You know, I know you have a camera guy obviously with you. Is that a local person or is that someone you've hired? Or is that your wife? Or how is the thought process in creating this content for this?
So for the most part, again, I've got a record of everyone who's messaged me on Instagram and said, come to my city. And so, so over time I will message them back and say, okay, I'm ready to come. Can you help me make it happen?
Do you have someone for Valencia? Do you have anyone?
No, I don't, but I do right now. So
add me to that Excel sheet. I know it's a long Excel sheet.
No, I mean, you know, and then basically because I'm self-funding all this, you know, I say to people like, is there any local sponsor, any local brand that can maybe help to alleviate the costs? You know, because the two biggest costs are obviously airfares and accommodation. And so where, you know, I say to them, like, is there any way you can either have someone sponsor me or take care of the airfares? Or even like in Iceland, for example, I stayed at this guy's house. He said, you can stay at my parents' house because they're away. And he said, is that okay? And I'm like, yeah, it's perfect. I mean, it's like an Airbnb, you know?
Right.
So I'm not saying, right, I must have, you know, Four Seasons hotel or anything like that. I'm basically just saying, if you can find me a bed, then that saves me $200 a night. And then, you know, if someone can support through other ways, whether it's either sort of cash or, you know, covering the airfare, then it's like, then I'm there. And then once I get there, I mean, I don't really have a cameraman. I sort of speak with that person. I say, listen, is there anyone who can help out by just holding my phone and shoot some stuff? And they usually got someone in Turkey, the guy's girlfriend. He said, oh yeah, I'll get my girlfriend to do it. And the funny thing was she was on a Zoom call, a work call, and she's like, so she's got her things plugged in and she's like this, you know, she's talking and doing all this. So that's
class.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to have the means to take a camera crew with me, you know, a photographer and a producer. And in Paris, that did happen. These guys from England who were fans, I was in England, we got in touch and I just said, I'm going to Paris for the day. I said, now they ran their own production company. And I said, listen, if I pay for your Eurostar fares, will you guys come out and shoot it and put it together? And they said, yep. And I said, okay, let's do it. So then in that case, I paid for them to come over for the day and it was great. But that's also, you know, a Eurostar from London to Paris is not an airfare from London to New York or anything like that. So it's, you know. And so it happened in that case. But for the most part, like in Mexico City last week, the guy who helped me put it together, I just said to him, I mean, can we get someone just to shoot the stuff? And he said, yeah, we'll just give the phones to people. And that's what happened. And now I'm sort of sorting through that. So,
Oh, you must have a lot of like footage from different angles and different people. It must be a mess to get through it. Are you editing all that yourself?
Yeah, I do all the editing.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, well, and that's where, again, the time-consuming efforts are, like when I'm looking through hours and hours, hours of footage to try to find the right clip to tell the right story, to put it into place and all that. I mean,
plus you have a mic probably, so you have to do some audio.
What I do now is I voice over the highlights because I tried playing in a microphone, but the sound is terrible because, yeah, you can't run them, not with the microphones I'm using. They're fine, but they're not the highest quality. And so I decided, okay, you know what, if I sort of do it as a commentary rather than the live audio, if I can pull that off, then that's all I really need. So, you know, you're always trying to find ways to sort of make it work, even if it's not perfect. Yeah. And so, you know, and again, there's so many skills in learning CapCut right now. You know, I watch people on TikTok and I'm like, okay, what did they do there? How did, what do yeah. I like?
You know, well, something I wanted to talk to you about, maybe we do that off air, some of sure. the more nitty gritty, like short form content. Cause I feel like I've had a lot of success with that lately. Maybe I can pass on some
yeah.
things I've learned. I don't know.
Yeah. 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 No, I mean, I think that's definitely how things happen from just learning from what other people do and how they do it. And what works for them and what they like in the formats, because, you know, again, there's some things that some people I like on TikTok and other people, I just don't like how they do their content, but that doesn't mean their content is good or bad. It's just for right. me, you know,
you're not watching. It's not your type of content. Yeah, of yeah. course. Of yeah. course. Last topic, I guess we're already approaching the hour mark. You were at the Eternal Derby in Belgrade. I was actually there last week watching Partizan versus Fenerbahce, which was an insane game that
yeah.
went down to the buzzer. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the Balkan atmosphere in general. I mean, the basketball games there, I feel like, are on a different level.
Yeah, the energy in the arena is just something I never expected. A lot of people told me before I went to Belgrade, they said, "You get ready, this is something crazy." And I'm like, "Okay, I've been to, you know, NBA finals games, like it can't right. be crazier than that." And then right. also it's like if you hype something up, if someone says to you, "Hey, you got to go to this restaurant or check out this movie or this TV show, it's the best one you're ever going to see." Now, if people say that, then the expectations are through the roof, and they almost never quite meet those. In Belgrade, I mean, 70, 80 minutes before the game, fans chanting and singing and taunting Red Star fans. And I was like, this is as loud as anything. And it still wasn't even packed. Like there was only probably right. half the arena. And I was like, well, there's just no way they're going to be able to maintain this energy and this level of emotion throughout a game. And it, like there was
And they do it. And then half an hour after the game, they do it.
And it just never ended, and it was just incredible. Now, look, obviously, Euro basketball is not at the same level as NBA, but the energy in the atmosphere is not something that I've felt in the NBA really like that for a continued, you know, the entire game. Maybe a couple of those finals games I've been to in Golden State, you know, were okay, but this level in Belgrade was like, okay, if you're a basketball fan, you've got to see a game there, you know. And it was just so much fun that I'm dying to get back there. I really want to go to more games because I want to see if it was almost that seduction of that one game, you know. Can it
no
you
it's know? Not it's not it's yeah. always like that. Even last week against Fenerbahce yeah. was insanity.
And so, you know, for me, that's the thing. Basketball is not like the NBA is not the only league worth watching or being involved in. You know, you can really have great experiences of basketball everywhere. You know, I went to Mexico City for a game just last weekend, and it was, you know, really good fun. Not quite as insane as Belgrade, but biggest crowd they've ever had for a G League game in Mexico City. So that was something. You know, I've been to Turkey. I went to Fenerbahce.
Oh, Turkey's on that level probably, yeah. or if not, yeah.
Yeah, same. Fenerbahce and FS last season where it was like the stakes were huge because if Fenerbahce won, that knocked FS out of the playoffs. If FS had won, they basically kept their season alive and put Fenerbahce on the brink. Now, yeah, so – and then in Lithuania for the Final Four last season, which was Barcelona, Olympiacos, Monaco and Real Madrid – you know, for and in a neutral venue, it was just insane, especially when Olympiacos played. So,
have you ever seen the? I was sorry to interrupt you. Have you ever seen the Richard Jefferson quote about? I think he went to a Partizan game or somewhere in Belgrade.
Yes, I do know it.
And he said, like, this compared to like the NBA is like the NBA is like a library.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, that's the thing. And
people
I think,
can't comprehend what that means. Yeah,
yeah. I think a part of it is though, you know, there are just so many games in the NBA that they lose, you know, they lose a little bit of their value, whereas in EuroLeague basketball, especially, every game is, you know, pretty big. And I think that's, you know, less is more in that sense. Like I feel, but again, I think like with baseball. And hockey as well, it's the same. Like baseball, I mean, they just play nonstop, you know, nonstop. And I'm like, if you're a fan, what difference does it make if you're playing the same team for the 10th, you know, for the 10th time that season? It just loses its appeal. Now, I love playoff baseball because it feels to me like, okay, every pitch really does, you know, the game is hanging on that pitch. But the regular season stuff for me is just like, you can lose 20 games in a row. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
You know, and the same,
you can have a bad 20-game stretch and it doesn't matter. What a crazy sentence.
Well, and you know, I think in the NBA, you can sort of see teams drop 10 or 11 in a row and it's like, but they could still make the playoffs. You know, that's where I think the NBA could really work on improving is like take out some of these games so that the value on each one increases, but they'll never do it. They'll never cut the season.
Sure,
down.
I mean that's never going to happen. That would be insane.
So, yeah. So, I mean, the owners just wouldn't approve of it because it means less gate money and it means less money. And that to me is what their product is. It's like we want to make as much money as possible, more games. But if you wanted the best product, I think you would have less games.
I think it's very hard to replicate the Balkan or even this Turkish league atmospheres. Yeah. And it's maybe you can reduce the games, but there's something in that water over there that's a little that's different. That's my feeling on it, at least.
No, it's true. It's true, too, that like it wouldn't just be a matter of like, okay, then all of a sudden, you know, the Detroit Pistons are going to be, you know, filling up their arena an hour before the game for a game against.
Right. You know, you wouldn't see flares against outside, downtown Detroit.
No.
Lee, thank you so much for an awesome conversation. We did an hour. It flew by.
Yeah.
I'm excited. Yeah. I'm excited for the rest of your tour. I was a big fan of the starters. I randomly actually got recommended. One of my friends sent me a video that you were in Croatia with Bronco, the sharpshooter. I was like, oh, man, Lee's making content about, he's traveling. Oh, this is cool. Like, let's binge watch a bunch of videos.
Yeah. Bronco is amazing. Yeah. I mean, he turned up and he just was a machine.
That's your most popular video, right? Yeah. That one killed it. Like that's his story. He's actually insane. Yeah.
my friend, Damien Rudej, he messaged me and he said, Branko's been getting all these offers to go on TV and stuff in Croatia.
So, no way.
That's
awesome.
I said to him, well, let me know if it happens, but he hasn't said it has happened yet. But Branko's actually kind of shy because I wanted to interview him myself afterwards, but he doesn't really speak English. And Damien said he's kind of quiet and shy anyway. So I don't know if it's going to happen, but he was awesome.
I'm excited for your next 20 countries. I hope, or cities. I hope Valencia is on there. I'll leave links down below to all your socials. Are you posting on everywhere? TikTok, Instagram?
Yeah. TikTok, Instagram. They're my main two. I'm on obviously Twitter as well, but I don't know what the hell Twitter is these days. And
okay.
I'm on YouTube.
And you've got a website as well.
Yeah, I got the website. Yeah. On YouTube as well. But even YouTube is a different animal, really. Like
it is,
you know,
it is.
My content is just more designed for TikTok and Instagram, really. I'm gonna be
we'll posted. Talk about I'll talk we'll talk about that after.
Yeah.
Some insight. Thank you so much for your time. It was an awesome conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.